We're continuing today in our series on the Sermon on the Mount compared with the Epistle of James. And today coming to this idea of the example of the suffering prophets. And there are so many great lessons in the Sermon on the Mount and the book of James. And I have mentioned on several occasions that it's almost like the Apostle James had a transcript of the Sermon on the Mount sitting on his desk before him as he wrote the book of James, because there's so much crossover, they're just so familiar. So here's what it sounds like in the book of James on the suffering prophets. Chapter 5, verse 10. Take the prophets, my brethren, who have spoken in the name of the Lord, for an example of suffering affliction and of patience. Behold, we count them happy who endure. You've heard of the patience of Job and have seen the end of the Lord, that the Lord is very pitiful and of tender mercy. So that's the book of James. On the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5, verse 11. Blessed you are, that means happy, blessed you are, when men shall insult you and persecute you and shall say all manner of evil against you falsely for my sake. Rejoice and be exceeding glad, for your reward is great in heaven. For so they persecuted the prophets which were before you. So you see the similarity here. James says, you're really blessed, you're really happy, you should rejoice, and you should be glad because the prophets were persecuted. And now you're a lot like them and you're persecuted. In James, take the prophets as an example of suffering. You know how happy they were when the suffering was over, so you should be like them. Well, because of these kinds of texts, in church history there have been some unusual things that have happened. So for example, between 1 and 300 A.D., when the Colosseum in Rome was being used with gladiatorial events and the persecution of Christians, we have these accounts of individual Christians running into the arena and saying, martyr me, martyr me. And there were beasts, you know, wolves and lions. And sometimes the wolves and lions would chase these people down and they really weren't hungry and they just turned away. And so nothing happened. And it was such an embarrassment to the church. This nut says, you know, kill me, kill me. And the lion goes there and the lion says, no, I don't think so. And it was a disgrace. In the late 100s, thousands of Christians in Carthage approached the Roman governor en masse, and they requested that they all be killed for the cause of Christ, executed by the Roman government for being Christians. And the governor said, no, I'm not doing that. In the mid-200s A.D., this one lady, her name is Agatha Niki, she was watching two Christians getting burned for their faith, and she became so captured by the idea that without anybody telling her to, she threw herself on the fire. Killed herself, you might say, so that she could be a martyr. Well, that's not right. In the early 300s, the Roman governor was interrupted in his courtroom by this guy named Eupolis, and Eupolis said, I'm a Christian, I want to die. So they killed him. In the early 400s A.D., when there was no more Colosseum to worry about, this one Christian wanted to be a martyr because, you know, Jesus said, happy are the prophets who've been persecuted. And he wanted to be persecuted. Nobody was persecuting him. So he purposely went to Persia and he burned down a temple, a pagan temple, because he knew if he did that, they would kill him. And, of course, that's the way it turned out. From 1000 to 1200 A.D., when the Crusades were taking place, the Pope promised that all the soldiers who died in the Catholic army would be granted martyrdom status in heaven forever. And so a lot of them wanted to become persecuted for Jesus' sake and did these crazy, horrible wars called the Crusades. Well, that's just such a mess. So this raises questions. Jesus said, you see how people were persecuted and they were rewarded and they're happy. Maybe that's the way you should feel. So since Jesus says this and James confirms it, then the question was, is suffering persecution for the Christian faith a necessary part of discipleship and heavenly reward? Jesus said they would receive rewards if they were persecuted. So maybe if we want rewards, we just have to be persecuted. The second question is living martyrdom. So when it happens in the 400s and thereafter A.D., since there was nobody persecuting the Christians, they decided that they would become monks and they would go out in the desert and live, and they would be poor. They would have no money and they'd live on terrible food. And sometimes, you know, worms would get in their digestive tract and infest them and they'd get sores, and the worms were in the sores. Terrible things. They said, well, nobody's persecuting me, so I guess I'm kind of just going to have to persecute myself. And that's what they did. They call that living martyrdom. I'm still alive, but look, I have no money and I have no health. Is that a good idea? Is that a necessary substitution for persecution so that you can have a reward? And the third big question, are there important differences between suffering from natural causes, say from cancer or from poverty, or suffering for the cause of Christ as a persecuted Christian? Is there a big difference? I remember one time when I was about 21 years old, I was teaching a young adult's Sunday school class, and we were talking about suffering in the Christian life, and one of the fellows in the class said, yeah, but Dave, there's a huge difference between suffering because you're being persecuted, somebody is after you for the cause of Christ, and just suffering because you have cancer. There's a big difference. And so in class, we had to kind of sort through that. Is there a big difference? And that's the question. Well, I have two big ideas to share with you today. The first big idea from these two texts of Scripture, Sermon on the Mount and Book of James, is this: rejoicing for the cause of Christ. You know, rejoicing for the cause of Christ, it makes sense. And it might be necessary for you to rejoice in persecution given the current cultural climate. You might have to rejoice in persecution in this generation. And that's okay. That makes sense. And the second thing we're going to talk about is rejoicing when we're going through natural hardships just because people are watching us and it matters. So two big ideas: rejoicing when people are persecuting you and, of course, the devil persecuting you, and rejoicing when nobody in particular is persecuting you but life is hard. Rejoicing either way. The idea here is that it's hard to be God's loyal friend. It is hard to be God's loyal friend when people who are hostile towards God become hostile towards you because you side with God. It's hard to be God's loyal friend when everybody's mad at God, and then because you side with God, they're mad at you. It's hard to be God's loyal friend. The second idea is also true, though. It's hard to be God's loyal friend when he decides to withhold relief from your pain, from your suffering, when he could so easily make you better. He could so easily fix it with just a wave of his hand, or less than the wave of his hand. He could easily fix it. And it's hard to be God's loyal friend when you know he could easily fix it, and he's not. In either case, it's hard to be God's loyal friend. And in both of these texts of Scripture, Sermon on the Mount, Epistle of James, we're seeing these points understood and clarified. Again, look what it says in the Sermon on the Mount. Blessed are you. You are a happy person when men shall insult you and persecute you and say all kinds of bad things against you falsely for me. Then you are a very happy person. Well, that text is teaching us that the Lord gives special consideration to the people who are insulted or demeaned by others because they've chosen to follow him. Special consideration. If people think badly of you because you are following Jesus, the Lord gives you special consideration for eternal happiness and rewards. Sabina Wernbrunn, you know Richard Wernbrunn, famous for his persecutions in the Soviet bloc countries back in the 60s and 70s. And he was persecuted for his faith and wrote books along those lines and started the organization for Christian martyrs. So he knows all about suffering for the cause of Christ. His wife was talking about what it's like, as Jesus said here, when people insult you and say all kinds of bad things against you falsely for my sake. She's interfacing with that. And she says, and she knows what real persecution is, including, you know, imprisonment, beatings, and death. So she knows all about that from the Soviet era. But here she says, physical hurt passes, and in a few hours may be forgotten. But humiliation, even when it is trivial, sears the heart. Only now was I beginning to understand why Jesus spoke of being mocked and crucified. I'd wondered before why mockery was worth mentioning in the same breath with crucifixion. And now I knew how it could hurt and go on hurting. You say, yeah, well, sticks and stones break your bones, but names will never hurt you. But that's not true. What people say about you matters. When people mock you, that's a really big deal. Now, Jesus said, if that happens, if people say bad things about you falsely because of me, I will give you special consideration in heaven and special reward. See, it matters to Jesus if people are mocking you. And that's likely going to be what you experience in your life. Christopher Hitchens recently passed away, but he did not like Christians. He was a very, very hostile atheist. And he said, religion poisons everything. And he said, the Bible was put together by crude, uncultured human mammals. He did not like the Christian faith, and he did not like the Bible. And he had some influence. Richard Dawkins was talking about parents not being allowed to teach their children religious doctrines if they want to. And he said it falls on the public school system, the state, to teach truth to the children. And if the parents get in the way, maybe the parents have to be put in prison. He was speaking about people like us. And he said, people who put the Bible ahead of scientific evidence. He said, you just have to write those people off. And a lot of people agree with Richard Dawkins. Sam Harris, another one of the four horsemen of the apocalypse, as the four young premier atheists were called. He also, an atheist, says, Christians have abused, oppressed, enslaved, insulted, tormented, tortured, and killed people in the name of God for centuries. Which, of course, is true. But I wonder if you could think of another category of people who acted opposite of that as Christians have. So that was only half a truth, right? A partial truth to hide the reality. Stephen Fry went off a few years ago in England. He's mostly a comedian, but he was deadly serious when he said this, speaking about God. It's perfectly apparent that God is monstrous, utterly monstrous, and he deserves no respect whatsoever. And he has some clout in our world. On the Black Lives Matter website, which of course is very important in our political world right now, they had this statement: we disrupt the Western prescribed nuclear family structure. Now, just pause there for a moment. He's calling it Western, but of course we're talking about Christianity here. And what we're really talking about is traditional family ethic. But the traditional family ethic to us has always been the biblical family ethic. So that's what they're really upset about. Say, we disrupt that. We are against the biblical family ethic. That is the reality that's being described here. We disrupt the Western prescribed nuclear family structure by supporting each other as extended families and villages that collectively care for one another. We foster a queer-affirming network. That's on the website. Well, clearly that's a shot against us. And you know right now, there is no political price to pay for getting angry at Christians and speaking badly about Christians. But there is a great political price to pay if you find fault with this website. At the Grammy Awards program in 2014, it featured the actual marriages of some same-sex couples on the show, as part of the show. And while the marriage ceremony was going on, in the background was being read excerpts from the Bible, 1 Corinthians 13, the love chapter of the Bible. One critic of Christianity, no friend of Christianity, he said, you know why they did this? This was a direct challenge to religious opposition. This was the influencers in Hollywood thumbing their nose at the Christians. That's why they did it. At the Smithsonian National Museum, there was this infographic on display for some period of time, called The Assumptions of Whiteness and White Culture in the United States. And one of those assumptions was emphasis on the scientific method, objective, rational, linear thinking, cause and effect relationships, quantitative emphasis. They said, that's the way white people think, and it's not necessarily true or helpful. It's not necessary for everybody to think that way. But of course, that has nothing to do with whiteness, really. That has to do with the Bible. And the Bible taught Christians everywhere to reject magical thinking. What happens in your life doesn't happen because the planets are aligned. It has nothing to do with it. You don't behave the way you behave because you're a Leo or a Scorpio. That's magical thinking. In the Bible, the Lord put the stars in place. They always move the same way all the time for seasons, and you can count on them. You can count on telling time by the movements of the universe. It's not magical. It's the same every day. So that's not really white thinking. That's Bible thinking. And the Smithsonian Institute put this as a white thing, but that's a Bible thing. Interestingly, the Asian people said, that's not white. We believe that. And so the Smithsonian had to take that down. But you see the problem. In the San Francisco Chronicle, 14 days after the 9/11 terrorist attack, this was written. The American flag stands for intimidation, censorship, violence, bigotry, sexism, homophobia, and shoving the Constitution through a paper shredder. Well, I mean, I could argue with some of those things, I guess, but I wouldn't care. I'm especially concerned about bigotry, sexism, and homophobia. That's not the American flag, really. That's the Bible. The Bible is opposed to homosexual activity. The Bible is the one that says that the male is the head of his house and males are the leaders of the church. So that's the real problem. It's not the American flag that started that. Those ideas were here a long time before there ever was an American flag. So you see, the real problem is we're against the biblical faith. The American Textbook Council in 2008 was evaluating textbooks that would be used in the public school system. They came back and they said this. While seventh grade textbooks describe Islam in glowing language, they portray Christianity in harsh light. Christians, they say, wage wars of aggression and kill the Jews. Islam provides models of harmony and civilization. So this is the textbook. You see, the Christians are bad, and you have to do something about that. In August of 2017, a professor, law school, University of Pennsylvania, wrote a public appeal for returning to the values of the 1950s. Here's what she said. That culture, you know, 1950s culture, that culture laid out the script we were all supposed to follow. Get married before you have children and strive to stay married for their sake. Get the education you need for gainful employment. Work hard and avoid idleness. Go the extra mile for your employer or client. Be a patriot, ready to serve the country. Be neighborly, civic-minded, and charitable. Avoid coarse language in public. Be respectful of authority. And eschew, avoid substance abuse and crime. She said we should all go back to that. Because she wrote those words, she was punished in her career, and she's not going to be ever again allowed to teach freshmen in college. And there were other punishments, publicly humiliating her for saying such a thing. But, of course, almost every item on that list comes directly from the New Testament. And you see, the problem is you can't say those things anymore. And Jesus said, well, if people insult you and say all kinds of bad things against you falsely, I will give you special consideration for eternity. After 8 days of nonstop protests by LGBTQ groups in London, Chick-fil-A decided to close their restaurant in England. They just give up. So you see, it affects your career, it affects your finances. You want to have a business, we're not going to let that happen. Persecution. Bills are filed from time to time. They don't get passed, but they're filed from time to time. That would prohibit Christian schools from establishing LGBTQ policies that would forbid students from being that, teachers from being that. Corporations are now afraid to give charitable donations to these Christian schools because the activist groups say, if you do give a donation to the Christian school that has such a policy, we will punish you, we will bad talk you on social media, and you will lose customers. Persecution. The founder of the Feminist Current, which is not a Christian organization in anything that they profess as far as I know, they're a pro-abortion, pro-gay rights organization. But the founder was banned from Twitter for arguing that men cannot be women. They said she's like a white supremacist for saying such a thing. October 13, 2019, Pastor Keith Simon in Columbia, Missouri, preached a very nice, kind, welcoming, gentle sermon in which he said that there are only two genders, male and female. Because he said that, on Monday, social media blew up and 1,000 citizens in his area pledged to boycott his church because he said such a thing. See, if people insult you and say all manner of things against you falsely for my sake, special consideration. June 6, 2015 was a big day in the United States. That's the day the Supreme Court ordered all states to recognize same-sex marriages. That in itself is not such a big deal. You know, it doesn't affect us in very many ways most of the time. But what that did is it made the biblical Christian faith officially and legally censured and shunned by the United States government and the majority of the citizens of the United States. The biblical faith became officially censured. They said that the biblical faith in that matter was inappropriate, contrary to civil rights, a threat to the public good, deserving of negative career and social consequences if you embraced that idea, and borderline illegal if you're talking about rejecting a student application from your school because of his feelings on those alternative lifestyles, or rejecting a teacher because of his alternative lifestyle, or if you want to have a leader who is required to have particular stances. And so you could be now breaking the law for being a Bible Christian. The Gallup poll people say trust and confidence in organized religion have plummeted over the past two decades. They call it a massive decline in trust for the Christian religion and others. The American Enterprise Institute says Generation Z, these are the children who were born in 1995 to 2010. Generation Z is the least religious generation yet. The Journal of the American Medical Association Psychiatry Journal said a mental health crisis has disproportionately affected young adults. I hope you're connecting the dots here. The least religious mental health crisis. The Institute for Family Studies says religious participation in adolescence is associated with greater psychological well-being, greater character strength, and lower risks of mental illness. In other words, trust has plummeted. Now there's a mental health crisis. Not only are the Christians not wanted and welcomed, they're being attacked. They're being objected to by emotionally unwell people. And that's a combination that is going to be hard to overcome. Jesus said, if people insult you, if they say all kinds of bad things against you falsely for my sake, special consideration. You are a blessed person. You are going to be rewarded. But you do see it's true, right? It's hard to be God's loyal friend when people who are hostile to God become hostile to you because you take God's side. And so that's why there's special consideration. But that's not the only person who gets special consideration. Another person who gets special consideration is the person who suffers well in natural hardships. That's nobody is hurting you. You just have sickness. You have poverty. You suffer well in natural hardships. And all the people who watch you are seeing then an opportunity for them to reevaluate their lives as it relates to hardship. Again, James 5:10, take the prophets. Take the prophets, my brethren, who have spoken in the name of the Lord for an example of suffering, affliction, and patience. Well, in the Sermon on the Mount, that's what we were doing. You know, what about those prophets? Well, Daniel was a prophet, and they put him in the lion's den. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they were prophets in their time, and they had to go in the burning fiery furnace. Now, the prophet Isaiah, he was placed inside a hollow log and cut in half with a saw. The prophet Jeremiah, he was stoned to death by his by his Israelite colleagues. So take the prophets, my brethren, who have spoken in the name of the Lord for an example of suffering, affliction, and patience. We count them happy, right? They're pretty great. They're heroes. We count them happy who endure. And you've heard of the patience of Job. Now, that's different, right? If he didn't say that, then I would think, oh, yeah, he's talking about Isaiah being cut in half and Jeremiah being stoned. I think that's what he means. But no, now he's going to talk about Job. Well, you've heard of the patience of Job. And you've seen the end of that story with the Lord, that the Lord is full of pity and has tender mercy. Now, see, Job is not like Jeremiah, who was stoned to death, or Isaiah, who was cut in half with a saw, or Daniel had to go in the lion's den, or Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego had to go in the burning fiery furnace. Job isn't like that. Job just suffered from natural things. It wasn't for his faith. He was robbed by bandits, and they didn't care whether he was a follower of God or not. A whirlwind came and knocked down his kid's house and killed his kids, and the whirlwind didn't care if he was a Christian or not. These are normal things. He got sores on his body. It's not because somebody was persecuting him. Of course, the devil was. But these are things that happen to all people. It's hard to be God's loyal friend when the people who are mad at God become mad at you because you're siding with God. But it's also hard to be God's loyal friend when he decides to withhold relief. And he is perfectly capable of fixing it. With no effort at all. Well, it's hard to be loyal to a God like that, right? But there's special consideration and special reward in heaven if you will be. Remember the three reasons for your suffering as a Christian, right? In the first case, to correct your waywardness. That is, you're doing something wrong and the Lord intervenes to stop you. So in 1 Corinthians 11, those people were behaving very badly, including disrespecting the Lord in the worship services during the communion service. And so Paul says, for this reason, many of you are weak and sickly, and a good many of you have died. So the Lord brought hardship into their lives to correct their waywardness. But see, this is a good thing because this increases your eternal happiness if your waywardness is corrected right. And it also makes you effective to be helpful to others. And you did want to be helpful to others, right? You didn't want to be wayward. You wanted to help others, right? And so suffering to correct your waywardness is a good thing. And the second reason that suffering comes is to accelerate our growth. This is John 15, and Jesus pruning back the grapevines. I'm the vine, you're the branches. Every branch that brings forth fruit, it is bringing forth fruit. It's doing a good job. What a good branch. It's bringing forth grapes. Every branch in me that brings forth fruit, the Father still cuts it back so that it will bring forth more fruit. You're doing a good job. The Lord isn't punishing you, but he's pruning you. He's going to bring hardship into your life, and now you're going to be better than ever. And that's a good thing, right? Because if this hardship makes you better than ever, well, now you're going to have more eternal happiness, more eternal reward, and that's good, right? Eternal happiness, that's pretty good, right? And you'll be able to help a lot more people. That's good, right? That's what you wanted to do. You wanted to be helpful in life. And because the Lord has accelerated your growth, now you're going to see these things accomplished. So the suffering that God could have fixed in a moment with the wave of his hand, he didn't fix. But it might be a good thing, right, if it accelerates your growth. And the third reason is to showcase your love and loyalty to God. That's what was happening in Job's case. The devil said, the only way anybody is ever going to be your friend is if you keep plying them to be your friend with favors. And if you quit giving them favors, God, you're not going to have a friend in the world. Not even Job, whom we both agree is extraordinary. He is going to curse you to your face. That's what's going to happen. And God said, I don't think so. I think Job will love me because of my character, because I am a truly loving God. And I think he likes me. I think he is attracted to me. And I don't think he's going to curse me to my face, even if we send him hardship. And the devil said, well, let's go ahead and see if that's the case. And the Lord said, why don't we just? And so there is God, who could have fixed the whole thing at any point, called off the test, standing by, with his arms folded and a smile on his face and being able to say to the devil, I told you that there were some people in this world who are attracted to me and who think I'm brilliant and loving and want to be my companion for all eternity. And Job turned out to be exactly that. So the suffering of Job wasn't really bad, right? It gave him eternal happiness, eternal reward above what he ever would have expected before. His love, you have to prove your mettle, you know. You're tough. You're really something. It's sort of like when we have an Ironman competition. And this guy is going to swim. He's going to get out of the water pretty tired. And he's going to get on his bicycle and he's going to ride like the wind. And when he's pretty tired again, he's going to start running a marathon. Say, you know what? You are the man. That is awesome. Well, Job is the man. He is awesome. And how do we know that? Because of the suffering. So the suffering wasn't really bad, right? It worked out to Job's eternal happiness and his eternal reward. So you see where we've been. There's already a terrible war against God exploding all around us. That's true. Ever since Adam first sinned and opened the gate of the universe to trouble, there's war. Before, the war was on the outside of the world. You know, that's just the devil being rebellious. But once Adam opened the gate, now the rebellion has come to our world. And you know what's really rotten? Sometimes I sin and help the devil in his rebellion. That's rotten. Now, when that happens, and by the way, this war is exploding all around us, right? And when I join the wrong side and I help the devil because I'm getting upset at somebody or I'm creating some kind of problem with God's pleasure and reputation in the world, I'm joining the devil, I'm marching with the devil, then the question is, am I asking God to just let me go on working with the devil in this rebellion? Is that what you're saying? Lord, take away this suffering, and when I'm wayward, you just let me be. Really? Even if that means that I am a fool? You know, don't correct me, Lord. Don't bring suffering into my life when I'm wayward. Don't mess with me even though I'm being a fool. You just let me be. Really? Is that what you want? And even if that means I'm messing up the lives of the people I love. Oh, yeah, when I do this, I'm going to mess up a lot of people's lives. But, Lord, don't mess with me. I just want happiness. Don't bring suffering to me. You just let me be wayward. Don't bring suffering. And even if that means my everlasting happiness is going to be diminished because of my waywardness, and the Lord didn't even do anything to stop me? Is that what you want? Maybe suffering is good. Maybe that's why God isn't removing the suffering from our lives when we're wayward. What if we're not wayward? What if we are being pruned to be better than ever? I was already a pretty fast runner. Now I'm a really fast runner because the Lord made me do two-a-days like that. There's already a terrible war against God exploding all around us, right? That's true. Once Adam opened the gate, that's where we are. That's where we live every day. And you know what that means? That means we're all in this fight. If we're going to join God's side, we're in this fight. And we're soldiering on the best we can. But here's the problem. We're pretty frightened most of the time. And we're pretty confused. And we're pretty much carrying on in chaos. So we're shooting our guns in this war, and we have no idea if we're hitting the targets. We're not even very good shots. And we're trying to be brave, but off in a corner, we're crying over here because we're really not that brave. And we're trying to soldier on, but we're not real good at it. And the Lord says, listen here. You are a fruit in my vineyard, a vine in my vineyard, and you bring forth fruit, but I'm going to help you out here. This is how we shoot straight. And when everything is chaos all around you, you have to locate your landmarks. You know where command is, right? Always know where command is. And make sure you're in the right place. And if you get pinned down, here's what you're going to do. You're going to leapfrog with your colleagues, with your brother fighters. Now, one guy is going to keep shooting so the other people can fall back. And then they're going to shoot and you fall back. And we're just going to keep working. This is how we're going to do it. Like, you're already a pretty good soldier. You know, you have a lot of heart and you're doing the best you can. But I'm going to teach you how to do this better, okay? So you're tracking with me? But you're going to have to work at this. You got to practice. It's going to be hard. Are you saying that you don't want God to bring hardship into your life because you'd rather just be a weak and clownish soldier? You're spraying bullets all over the place and you don't know where command is. You don't know what you're doing. But Lord, you leave me alone. Don't you bring hardship in my life. I'll resent you for it. Don't you do it. Don't prune me back. I don't want to be better. Really? Even if that means that you're not able to help people very well in life. All your loved ones who might have been more helped by you if you'd just been pruned back, if you'd gone through suffering, if you just become a little better. But no, I don't really care how they do. It's just really all about me. And Lord, you better not bring suffering into my life. And even if it means it's going to diminish your eternal happiness and reward if the Lord doesn't cut you back. Really? Is that what you want? There's already a terrible war against God exploding all around us. There's nothing God can wisely do about that. Of course, he could end it, and he will, in the end times, end it, but not yet. And so what's left is that we all have to be soldiers for Jesus. People are declaring their loyalties. Whose side are you on? Well, you tell people what side you're on, and they get sore at you these days, right? Whose side are you on? And so there's suffering. People talking bad about you falsely for Jesus' sake, right? Are you saying, Lord, I'm going to be a soldier in this war that's exploding all around me, but here's what I really want. I want a desk job, you know, like far away from any guns and things that blow up. I just want to be that kind of a soldier. You don't want to suffer for the Lord. You don't want to be one who sacrifices for the cause, for king and country. No, I don't want to sacrifice. You just keep all of that bad stuff away from me. Really? That's what you want. That's what you want. Even if it means you're not going to be any particular help to God. The people that you love, you're not particularly going to help them because you just want to keep everything far away from the gunfire. Stay far back. I don't want to help. You don't? So you're not really going to help anybody. You're not really going to have eternal happiness and reward that comes to the heroes. And no, I don't want that. You just make my life easy for a few years now, and that's all I care about. Imagine if you could make a pact with God. I thought about actually, you know, making a contract like this and daring you to sign it. So here's your contract to God, right? Here's your contract. God, you just let me march with the devil whenever I want to, and don't correct me. Don't bring hardship into my life to make me quit doing that. You just let me march with the devil whenever I feel like it. And you let me mess up a lot of the lives of my loved ones. If I want to, I can. You just don't bring hardship to correct me. And I don't want to show them how to really live the Christian life. I don't want to show them how to be a good soldier. You just let me mess them up if that's the way it is. And then you just let me have diminished happiness in heaven. And no particular reward. You just let me have it. It's all good with me. As long as you just don't bring any hardship into my life for the next few years until I die. So that's what I'm telling you. You keep the hardship away, and I'll deal with diminished happiness forever, messing up a lot of lives, and being a nobody in your service. I'll do that. Would you sign that contract? That would be a fool's contract. What a terrible idea. Suffering is not a bad idea in many cases. Conclusion. Is suffering persecution for the Christian faith a necessary part of true discipleship and heavenly reward? No. But thinking that God is brilliant and kind in the midst of suffering definitely is. Nobody needs to persecute you for you to be great for Jesus. But when suffering comes, and believe me, suffering will always find you. Suffering will find you. When suffering does find you, if you think that God is still brilliant and wonderful, then you are qualified for special consideration and reward in heaven, special happiness. Is living martyrdom a good substitute for persecution. That is, I'm going to make myself poor. I'm going to make myself sick. I'm going to deprive myself. Is that a good idea? No, not necessarily. But being willing to cheerfully endure pain and poverty for God, that definitely is necessary for real discipleship. You have to be willing to do it, or you can't have the reward of those who have done it. At least you have to be willing to do it. So then, is there a big difference in God's mind now between suffering well in the midst of natural causes like cancer and poverty, like in the story of Job, or suffering well in the midst of persecution, as in the stories of Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, Isaiah, Jeremiah? Is there a big difference in God's mind between what Job did and what the persecuted prophets did? The answer is no. Both kinds of sufferers are heroes in God's kingdom. Suffering is going to find you. Maybe it'll find you because you're like Isaiah and you get cut in half someday. Or maybe it'll find you because you're like Job and just came to you as part of living in this bad world. Either way, if you'll suffer well, you'll have special consideration and reward. It's hard to be God's loyal friend when people who are hostile towards him become hostile towards you because you keep siding with him. It's hard. You might think, well, I'm going to throw off this Christian life because it's too much trouble. And it's hard to be God's loyal friend when you're going through a hardship and you know he could fix it with the wave of his hand and he doesn't even try. It's hard to be his loyal friend when that happens, isn't it? But here's what we learn from the Sermon on the Mount and James the Apostle. You're a blessed person when you trust the Lord in those hardships. And you should be glad. And you know they're happy who endure. And they rejoice and be exceedingly glad because they see the end. And hopefully you see the end.